In many ways, what I wanted out of this essay by Edward Baugh, the West Indian writer and his quarrel with history, is little more than this passage that he begins the essay with from Derek Walcott. The essay, Baugh's essay, is really, I think it's fair to say, nothing quite more than a love letter to Derek Walcott. And I really love that about the essay. I think more of these essays that just say, here's somebody who has a brilliant vision and I'm going to document it, contextualize it, but in the end, just lift it into this sort of profound space of not elaboration or analysis or critique, but really just a lavish presentation. And that's always what comes to mind when I read the West Indian writer and his quarrel with history, is this, it has a kind of lavish language, and it's really indulgent of Walcott's best ideas. But it's this quotation that he gives, from an essay titled The Caribbean Culture or Mimicry, an essay that is published in the Journal of Inter-American Studies from 1974, which is exactly the same time or same year as The Muse of History. So it's part of Walcott's moment of thinking about history, paternity, and identity. But I really like this part where he says, quotes from Walcott, where Walcott writes, "In the Caribbean, history is irrelevant, not because it is not being created or because it was sorted, but because it has never mattered. What has mattered is the loss of history, the amnesia of the races, and what has become necessary is imagination, imagination as necessity, as invention." This is, for me, really one of the most important passages in, and really underappreciated passages outside of Baugh's treatment in the Caribbean critical tradition. I love the passage because it does a couple of things that we've been wrestling with across a series of readings, which is, what is the meaning of the past, right? What is the meaning of place? And what is the responsibility or duty of the writer and artist? And the meaning of the past, I think one of the things that's been a constant across the course is that very question, whether it was the very first readings and conversations we had about Césaire and the Culture and Colonization essay, which talked about the past as a conservation of elements of Africanness that then can be reanimated or reconfigured in light of the critical imagination, a critical imagination that is fundamentally reactivating, right? That reanimating a past that has become like this flickering flame. And now through the poet's imagination, that past of Africa, that Africanness, can have its fullness. So the past can mean that kind of atavism, the atavism of that moment, that sense of, you know, an originary place, is something that then, you know, in some ways the surrealists try to get some distance from by saying, like, let's talk about the landscape and the body and the elevation of the senses through a certain kind of perception, you know, animated by Breton, but really trying to break from that notion of the past and a need for Africa and that everything is in front of us that we need, a sort of intense presence, right, that doesn't even have a future and doesn't even have a past, right? Just the intensity of the present, which says something about the meaning of history. We also, of course, Fanon, that's famously, you know, in the conclusion to Black Skin, White Masks, you know, we're not slaves to history, we're not history slaves, there's no need for reparation, there's no need for return, what we need is a pure future. Again, the meaning of history. Then in getting into Glissant and companion writers like Brathwaite, Wilson Harris, and of course, Derek Walcott, history begins to take on this more complicated, I think more complicated or at least more layered meaning, which is that it's the composite structure of traces of memory rather than a single memory, or rather than a single memory that's broken into pieces we could put back together to be exactly what it used to be. And in that, in a Creolist, very much indulge it, Condé indulges it, the same kind of idea of the past as a composite of fragments. But one of the things that we haven't quite talked about, and I really like that Baugh through Walcott draws it out, is this question of imagination and invention. What does it mean to think about the imagination as fundamentally inventive? That is, the imagination not as something that, not the imagination as something that reassembles what's in front of us in new and important ways, but really that really deep and profound sense of invention, of really making something for the first time. I think in its best moments, that's what creolization means for Glissant. I think that's the beauty of nation language for Brathwaite, and obviously for Walcott, it's what's possible in the present. And the Antilles essay really lays out some of the deeper or wider political and historical concerns that inform that notion of invention. But this notion of invention and imagination at the same time, and how it, you know, what is the imagination in its inventive register? What is it working with? What is it attending to? And so part of why I wanted to conclude the curriculum for the course with both Perry Hensel's film, The Harder They Come, which is a genre film. It's a Western or a gangster film, some sort of hybrid of those two. Homage to blaxploitation films like Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Certainly there are a number of shout outs in The Harder They Come to Melvin Van Peebles' work, but also you know, this the gangster as hero and the Western, you know, the outlaw who flees, you know, the police and the state, you know, in the interest of his own independence, his own freedom. But it has, of course, a completely different West Indian register, or Jamaican in this case, register. And that Jamaican register is, you know, the post-colonial state as fundamentally failed at some level. And the attempt in the film to find a sense of freedom in a failed state. And so for me, there are a couple of things that really stand out in the film for me. And this is, you know, I'm just sketching out some things here because each thing could have its own kind of depth, right? But I'm interested in how Hensel in the film is trying to locate art, in this case, reggae music, locate art in relation to the streets, right? To everyday people. To vernacular culture, as we've been talking about, to the everyday hustle and bustle of life, of regular and poor folks. That's drawn out, I think, in part by the main character's you know, journey, right? That he comes from the countryside to the city to try to find work, right? To try to find a meaningful life. And it, the contrast of his own journey, right? As a sort of poor boy, working class hero sort of figure, his journey from that to the music studio is gatekept by studio executives. They're very small studios, so we can't overplay this as some sort of massive, like, US-based label, right? But there are local labels that, you know, have exploitive contracts that that don't care as much about the artistry as they do about the potential of sales, right? So there's all kinds of ways that plays out, right? About the producer thinking it's not going to be a hit, burying it, requiring these terrible terms, not letting him profit from his own music in the way that he deserves and all of that. But I think what catches my eye in that part, that aspect of the film, which in some ways is the core of the film, is this conversation that we've been having ever since the Muse of History and a conversation we had about Walcott's remark on the fisherman and the farmer, who he says already know who they are. Right? It's when we try to analyze and theorize their lives, right, that we overlay terms that can't make sense of their lives. What would it mean to think from their perspective, right, rather than from the alienated intellectual's perspective. I think in some ways we see that played out in The Harder They Come as the non-alienated artist, right? The artist of the people. And the way he affirms that is by being a criminal. By being a criminal, right, and fleeing the police and becoming a national or at least urban legend, a legend in that urban space, is not because there's something like criminal about the underclass or something like that. That's not at all what Hensel's getting at. I think what he's getting at is that in a failed post-colonial state like Jamaica, because it fails to provide for its people, it fails to avoid the corruption of colonialism in the moment of independence, right? That the everyday people, the working class, the underclass, the poor, they all live as criminals, right? They literally live under constant suspicion of the police. They live under conditions of absolute exclusion from politics and the formal economy. So when he becomes an outlaw in the film, he becomes a representation of the people, not because the people are outlaws, right, as a matter of character, but because the people, by virtue of the fact that they are the underclass, the people are outlaws. They're outside the law of the failed post-colonial state of Jamaica. And in that, I think it's really important that the music and the way his music is portrayed, he doesn't have any precedent. Right? There's something like, wow, we've never heard anything like this. And what if we made it like this so it sounds a little bit more like the other hits, right? But his insistence on his own voice. And there are those amazing moments where he's recording, that amazing scene where he's recording the title track, The Harder They Come. And we have those shots of him in the studio. And for me, it's some of the most beautiful filming of a recording session I've ever seen, because it really lets you see the almost spiritual possession of Jimmy Cliff, who you know, is the singer and the actor, that we see Jimmy Cliff's ecstasy as a song maker, right? He's possessed by his music, but it's also in that way, Hensel's way of affirming this notion that this is his own invention, that he's not imitating anyone, right? That there is no mimicry, in this case, by the man of the people, right? He doesn't set up something to be mimicked, and he is the mimic of no one. And that sense of inventiveness, that sense of finding a way to make your music, right, your art, relevant without the support of the state, without the support of capitalist institutions like the studio, however small, it's an exploitive capitalist system. That insistence on making his own identity and his own possibilities as a musician is such an important arc of the film and such important feature of Hensel's vision of the relationship between art and the vernacular, that for me is also manifesting this notion of invention and imagination that Walcott is talking about, where it's really like it's playing out Walcott's remark in The Muse of History about, you know, the fisherman knows who he is, right? The musician knows who he is, right? But also imagination and invention, that he has his own voice. He has his own inventive and imaginative world, and he brings it to sound. And whatever the relationship of an economy, of a national or local economy, to that inventive, imaginative, aesthetic object, the song or songs, whatever those relationships to it, right, it remains an enigma, right, a singular production, precisely because it's his own sound, his own voice. But at the same time as being his own sound and his own voice, and this is I don't want to say it's the paradox, but it's the complexity of Caribbean notions of inventiveness, that it's an inventiveness by the artist, an imagination of the artist, but it's an inventiveness and imagination that is an expression of the people. And that coincidence or that collapse of the individual artist and the people is, I think, so much of what the Creolists are after. They're like, what is the sound of our place? Well, The Harder They Come gives us a musical reckoning with exactly that question. A musical reckoning with exactly that question, because, you know, there are other ways we could think about it, but, you know, The Harder They Come is about a musician. And that brings me to the Wailers album, Burnin', which I think is one of the very, very few masterpieces of music in the Americas. It's has a coherence to it that is so, and an expansive vision to it that is so unique and so important. It is an album recorded around the time of this Derek Walcott quote, the muse of history, you know. But it is also a way of reckoning with a failed post-colonial state. And I keep saying failed post-colonial state because there's something really important about the persistence of colonialism in that moment of failure. And so what for me is so interesting about the Wailers album is, first of all, its coherence and its expansive vision, which is it ends with Rastaman Chant, which is it's a religious song, but it starts out with this political invocation, right, to stand up for your rights. And interspersed between there are all kinds of religious visions, political visions, political militancy, love and friendship, sexuality, playfulness around politics, but also, you know, burning and looting is not playfulness. Small Axe has a kind of playfulness to it, while also obviously a very serious message of, you know, we're going to chop you down, but it's a playful song, whereas burning and looting is very dire and intense. In terms of its vision of apocalyptic destruction. I like that about it. I always like apocalyptic visions, limits or possibilities. I just like apocalyptic visions. I feel like they take the pain of the world really seriously. And I think in that way, Burnin' does that. As well, of course, there's calls for both unity and disunity. The unity being the unity of the we. You know, we will, we are, we might be, see us, think about us. All of those us, right? All of those we characteristics. It's really important, and this is a problem in interpreting Marley's music broadly, although The Wailers is not a Marley album, it's a Wailers album. So it's before he became like the sole face of the band and really of his own music. But the we in Marley's music generally and in Burnin' as an album, I think it's really important to remember that the we there is the underclass of Jamaica. It's not we humans. It's not we Caribbeans. It's not we Jamaicans. It's we the underclass, right? The I Shot the Sheriff, which in some ways has become like the cliche, one of the cliche sort of go-to Bob Marley songs. If you listen to that song seriously, it is such a serious song. I mean, it's a song about, you know, fighting the police with mortal violence. They kill us. We kill them. But why do we kill them? To instigate revolution, to instigate overcoming the failed post-colonial state and the neo-colonial ghosts that haunt the post-colonial state. And very much that's what the album is about. And so in like Doopy Conqueror, which is about conquering the ghosts of the past, part of that is about the sense of self-worth that comes from the legacy of the Middle Passage and slavery and colonialism, but it's also the ghost of colonialism in the post-colonial state. How do you conquer that, right? How do you conquer that? Well, the stakes could not be higher, right? That refrain from the chorus, we'll be free again, right? We'll be free like we were in Africa. But that only happens if you conquer the ghost of colonialism, the ghosts of slavery and colonialism and the Middle Passage, all of which have combined and piled on top of each other to create a sense of natural subjection or worthlessness of life among the underclass. And that, in the end, is what the we of Burnin' is all about. Burnin' is not about the we of Jamaica or the Caribbean. It's the we of the underclass. There's also so much on the album, and it's a thing that I think is probably my favorite part of the album, which is something that really harkens back to the Surrealists, although it's not a surreal album at all. It's just a straightforward, bass-heavy Lee Perry, who's a creator of dub, very heavy bass Lee Perry dub remixes and mixes, not remixes, mixes of the tracks. But alongside that very heaviness of the politics and the cultural critique and of the bass sound, which I think is supposed to give that, you know, very masculine depth, you know, I think it's a limit of the album, but the very masculine depth of its militancy is, I don't want to say offset, but it's complemented in really important ways, in ways that I think was really key that we think hard about. It's offset or complemented by this musicality and playful lightness of musicality that is just so unfathomable. I mean, there are moments on this album where I can't believe human beings are making this music. And in that, I'm always struck by, and Dupi Conqueror is a great example of this if you listen to it, where there's all these sort of bird sounds and chirps that the background singers, mostly Peter Tosh, but other background, other musicians as background vocalists are making, that when I think about the surrealists, especially Suzanne Césaire, but also René Manil, talking about how it's important for us to find a space for the for landscape in the Caribbean imagination and Caribbean cultural production, I'm like, that's what that is. That's the sound of surrounds. That's the sound of birds. That's the sound of animals and people, like making sounds, yelping, yelling, chirping. All of these sounds in the background of life are now brought into this heavy, bass-heavy, militant political vision that's also liberatory, that's Rastafarian for all of its good and bad aspects. It's Rastafarian and it's deeply spiritual, like that sense of militancy to the spirit, right? And the playfulness of love songs like Put It On, I think give a sense of musicality and lightness that reintroduce a notion of landscape to what is otherwise often a very dark vision of the failed post-colonial state. A very dark vision that I think the deep bass sounds that Lee Perry makes the centerpiece of the track, of all the tracks really, with only a couple of exceptions, that juxtaposition, right, is the juxtaposition that surrealism was always looking for. That juxtaposition, and this is where I'll conclude, that juxtaposition of the heaviness of history, the heaviness of political exploitation and suffering, and the lightness of the fact that everyday people have played alongside suffering. They have listened alongside their fear. And they want that complexity of life to be represented in that inventive imagination. The harder they come, right, the music is deeply political and about the post-colonial failed state and connecting with the underclass. What I like about Burnin' is it wants that same thing, but I think it accomplishes it. It accomplishes that goal of finding an inventive imaginative space in the underclass by activating not only their political rage, but also the playful, beautiful, everyday sounds of life.